Hey guys, this is Ryan. Real quick, before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to share with you a new podcast that one of my good friends, Preston Lee, has been working on. It's called Freelance to Founder, and it tells the stories of solopreneurs who've grown their one-person business to be something much bigger than just themselves. And what I like most about Freelance to Founder is that it's not just a typical interview show. They instead use narrative storytelling to dive deep into what it's really like to scale a one-person business. And right now, the show is in its fifth season. The previous four seasons have been packed with incredible guests like Chris Doe, Cynthia Johnson, Brennan Dunn, Courtney Brown, Sean McCabe, and seriously, dozens of more. So I would love to have you guys check out the show. I know you're going to like it just as much as I do. So you can hear it at freelancetofounder.com. And you can click on the link in the show notes of this episode of the Side Hustle Project as well. And you can search for Freelance to Founder in your favorite podcasting app. So without further ado, let's get into today's episode. Welcome to the Side Hustle Project, a podcast where we explore the nitty-gritty details behind what it takes to start and grow a profitable side hustle. I'm your host, Ryan Robinson, and in this podcast, I'm bringing you interviews with entrepreneurs, best-selling authors, CEOs, investors, and people just like you who are building and profiting from interesting side hustles. In today's episode, we're talking to Lydia Lee, the career transition coach extraordinaire behind Screw the Cubicle, where she's helped hundreds of people to build purposeful businesses and strategically leave their day jobs for good. Originally from Vancouver, Canada, Lydia has spent most of the last 5 years living the life of a digital nomad and spending the bulk of her time in Bali. After going straight into the workforce after college and working for years in a corporate job she wasn't in love with, it was then that Lydia decided to make a change. She took a hard look at what she was good at her job and the components of it that she actually enjoyed most, and she started building a freelance consulting business on the side of her full-time work. Once she had a little traction with that, Lydia pitched her boss on transitioning out of working full-time for the company and into a 25-hour-per-week consulting position, doing just the tasks she was best at and enjoyed most. She helped her boss find people to replace everything else that used to be on her plate, and they struck a win-win deal together. Since then, Lydia's grown her consulting business, launched her blog Screw the Cubicle, and has since transitioned over to working full-time on her blog and with helping coaching clients to do exactly what she's done and ditch their day jobs forever. In this episode, Lydia and I talk about how she identified a profitable niche to start consulting on the side of her day job, including the very specific ways she activated her own interests, navigated her non-compete agreement with her employer, and the simple strategy she used to land her first paying client. We cover Lydia's take on the biggest mistakes people make and the pitfalls to avoid when launching a side hustle. We dive into how to find the right business idea for you, how to build rapid traction with your side hustle, the steps you'll need to take when preparing to quit your day job, and seriously, so much more. As always, you can find everything we mentioned in today's episode in the show notes at ryrob.com/podcast. That's spelled ryrob.com/podcast. Let's get into today's interview with Lydia Lee. Lydia, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ryan. Happy to be here.
I'm so excited to talk to you. I've been familiar with your work for several years now. So this is the culmination of a lot of reading of your blog. But I do want to kick this off with my first question that I ask to all of the guests here on my show. So Lydia, what book are you reading right now, or what has been a favorite of yours recently?
You know, funny enough, I've been rereading a book that I have read many years ago, The Alchemist. Paul Coelho, I think I'm saying the last name right. Hopefully I'm saying the last name right. And it was sort of brought upon back to my reality from actually this project that I've been wanting to start in Bali since I arrived there 5 years ago, which was to take people on a bit of a self-discovery journey, but really a journey to sort of think outside the box. And I love adventure, and Bali is a huge adventure spot. So I was trying to make a sort of live challenge, physical challenge, sort of like think about Amazing Race, you know, meets like a Tony Robbins event where they get to sort of explore more about their character and their courage through adventure. And so one of my coaches, Pam Slim, who's an amazing person who wrote The Body of Work and Escape from Cubicle Nation. I'm not sure if you heard of her, but she was someone that prompted me to go, hey, you know, you should really reread The Alchemist again as a way of looking at the hero's journey. again. And when I read The Alchemist, it was sort of years ago before I quit corporate, actually. And I never really understood it very much until I went on my own personal hero's journey of transition and sort of reinventing my own life. And so that's, yeah, the book I've been reading and sort of getting back into, you know, using that book as a way of looking at how I too can sort of take you know, humans on this journey on more of a physical adventure in this little personal project I would like to start next year in Bali.
I love that. And I feel like when you're reading a book like this with such a clear purpose too, then you're just going to get so much more out of it.
That's it. And I think sometimes certain books need to be reread at certain stages of your life when you're a little bit more open, you know, to welcoming the concepts of it. So for example, The 4-Hour Work Week was something I had to read about 5 times. You know, until I really realized what it meant to be location independent and what sort of things had to happen for me. Because it, when I first read that book, it was sort of, I thought was more for coders. You know, digital nomadism was for coders, programmers, techie people. And that wasn't my background. And it wasn't until I sort of met someone else who had a similar background than I did that utilized and leveraged those ideas into their career that it meant then meant something to me. You know, so the fifth time I read that book was when I was leaving to Bali 5 years ago. And then it made more sense about what I needed to do about those practices, you know, that Tim Ferriss was really banging on about in the book.
Mm-hmm. So, Lydia, do you have a name yet for the Survivor Competition meets Tony Robbins event? That's a long name right there.
I'm probably going to crowdsource that name. I find that my community has excellent ways of giving me awesome names. I'm a better storyteller than I am a copywriter. You know, so what I find actually most of the names of my programs in the past have been actually given to me by my audience, which I think is lovely, you know, because they're the ones that are the audience and they have great ideas. And I am not the only one with all the answers.
Wow. That's a strong dose of humility.
It really is.
So Lydia, you mentioned earlier that you spend most of your time in Bali, or that you have at least for the past 5 years. So that sounds kind of like a dream to me. But where are you originally from?
So I was originally from Vancouver, Canada. Well, I was born in a little island called Penang in Malaysia. Do you know this island?
I'm not familiar with it, no.
Well, I might be biased, but to me, it is actually the best, if you're looking for a foodie haven and the best Southeast Asian food in the world, you need to go to Penang. It's a small little island, okay. Not far from the capital of Kuala Lumpur. That's where I was born, and my family and I moved to Canada when I was about 8 years old. So I grew up in Canada. This is sort of the culture that I know, and I've been living in Vancouver pretty much my entire life. I never traveled, to be honest, when I was younger, and it wasn't until I took my sort of first sabbatical in my mid-20s that I sort of saw the world a little bit. But yeah, so Vancouver is where I'm from and Bali is where I've been based in the last 5 years.
How did you land on Bali as a new home?
To be honest, that was a bit of an accident as well, Ryan. It's sort of how what happens to me in general. I actually was running 2 businesses at the time when I decided to take a trip abroad. Now, as I said, I never did the whole backpacking thing or gap year. I think the Europeans sort of have this gap year stuff that happens for them after university. I never did any of that. So I sort of went straight to university after high school. I went straight to work after university. I never had a time of a sabbatical of sort of personal travel. And when I had my first business, it wasn't Screw the Cubicle. It was actually a consulting business, which is what I would call a transition business now. Which was sort of an easy thing to start for me in the same industry, you know, same context, same rules that I knew, except I was working as a consultant. And at the time I started a blog called Screw the Cubicle, which wasn't meant to drive any revenue to it at all. It was mainly an online journal to document my identity crisis going through the corporate transition. Mm-hmm. And then people started reading it and, you know, it all sort of came about to me that it could be a business when someone started asking for help in my blog. But at the time I was sort of trying to figure out how to look at Screw the Cubicle as a business and maintain my consulting business that was, you know, paying the bills. And also realizing that as a startup, it was really difficult to start it in a place like Vancouver because of sort of high rental prices. I was someone that didn't take out a loan, you know, to start a business. And I didn't have a lot of money to sort of invest into, you know, help that I needed in my business, things I didn't know how to do or were good at in my business, usually techie things. And then again, like I said, I picked up the 4-Hour Work Week again, sort of thought about how to make my business location independent. At the time, I was seeing clients in real life and started to transition my business into more of a remote business and testing it out for about 6 months. So originally my idea was just to go to Asia where the living costs were lower. I could sort of spend more of my money with support systems and people I could hire to help me advance my business and really see if people would fire me if I wasn't physically there. You know, could I do my work location independently? And so the first idea was just to leave for 6 months. I went to Cambodia for the first month, realized the internet was pretty crap. And then I was writing my first e-course at the time, you know, writing curriculum for the first time. And I asked Facebook, where should I go to do some writing? And I could do some yoga and sort of have a good quality of life. And someone had mentioned Ubud. And so I trekked my way there. It was supposed to just be a 30-day sort of trip and then ended up never leaving. And that was 5 years ago. So that's sort of what happened.
I love that. Well, something obviously clicked.
It did. Yeah. You know, one of the biggest things of the reason why I think I've stayed in Ubud, not only because it's a beautiful, obviously a very gorgeous place, Bali, but actually the community has been what helped me there. You know, when I landed there, the whole co-working movement, digital nomadism was still just a pretty new thing. You know, I actually checked myself into the first co-working space ever to be constructed in Bali called Ubud with an H. They were also ran by two Canadians that I now know and call them as friends. And I met my people. You know, I met remote workers. I met people with families, people that did, you know, were striving to have a much more sort of freedom-based life. And it was awesome to have people around me because it is lonely to be on the road. I'm not someone that wants to backpack every month. You know, I like stability. Yeah. I crave community. I sort of can't function without community. So that really ticked the boxes for me to stay there.
So Lydia, one thing you mentioned was the topic of transition businesses. And I think that's something that a lot of people listening today will be able to kind of relate to. It's a path that I myself also went through doing consulting work on the way to getting a more sort of passive, I guess you could say, business off the ground. And I think that that's a path that a lot of people should take and are currently taking. So they take their skill that they build in their day job. They go out, they build sort of a side consulting business. They make the leap to that full time while they figure out what's going to come next. So does that sound like a path that a lot of people you know have gone on?
Absolutely. It was my journey as well. You know, it was easier for me to start something I knew. You know, it may not be a forever business. And I think that's sort of the misconception a lot of people have when they don't start anything is because they're sort of waiting for like the perfect idea to hit them in the face. You know, something that will be forever and that will make them money while they sleep, you know, whatever ad they've been seeing on Facebook, that seems too good to be true, right? Mm-hmm. But a consulting business and a service-based business and this, you know, leveraging expertise, right, of what you already know and working for yourself is an excellent way to do it because it doesn't, as a consulting business, it doesn't require as much investment, you know, to have a physical product. It doesn't take much to start. You very likely have low-hanging fruit people that you can tap into, you know, in past work experiences in the past or colleagues or bosses you've worked for. You've built social equity in some way, right, in the career you've had so far. So that transition into a freelance career around being a consultant is easier. And I think it builds that confidence a bit faster as well when you're starting with something you know. You know, and slowly sort of, you know, expanding your courage into understanding how to go after clients and make money on your own without it being, you know, being under a company that you used to sort of be familiar working with.
Yeah. And I'm assuming that, you know, your trajectory was building up the side consulting business while you still retained your day job, or did you sort of axe your full-time job and then jump into consulting?
Listen, I am not as risky as most people think I am. You know, when they look at, you know, the word screw the cubicle, they're like, wow, you must just sort of just do it. And that's not true. I you know, I come from a very risk-averse immigrant family, you know, that gave up a lot to have a future for me. And it was very instilled in me to not do anything scary and to be by the book. I mean, I am one of the only entrepreneurs in like 60 years in my family. You know, and most people, I think, are built like me. They're sort of not a I'll jump off the cliff and hope the parachute opens kind of people. You know, I'm a calculated risk person. And for me, I needed to feel safe. And those conditions of safety financially and also in terms of what could be for me in possibility, I needed to craft that up while I was still stable in a full-time job. And I think that is actually a perfect way to start, because the last thing you want to do when you start a creative project, when you go into the world of the unknown, is to feel shaky financially. You know, that's sort of the baseline. We need to feed ourselves. We need to put shelter over our heads. We need to feel safe in order to even feel the feeling of creativity. You know, if our baseline needs aren't being met, there's no way creativity will birth from that place.
I love that quote. We need to feel safe in order to even get creative.
Totally.
I love that a lot. So, you know, going back in your own sort of personal journey here, do you remember the very first client that you landed on your own?
Absolutely. It was someone I already met through my corporate gig in a conference many years ago. And I was looking at opportunities of what I could do that wasn't going to be competing to the work I was currently doing. Because, you know, I had a non-compete, for example, that I signed in my work. Yeah, you do have to look at that. But it didn't say that I couldn't play in the industry. I just could not create a business that was the same business of who I was working for. And that's fair. And I wasn't interested in building a school anyway. So I used to work in international education. But what I started to look at was other gaps of opportunities in the industry that wasn't being serviced. You know, programs, for example. So that's where my creativity brain kicked in. Was I was great at marketing, and I was great at selling a program or packages for schools. But what I saw was a missing opportunity, that these programs were really paint by numbers, very traditional education programs. And what I was more interested in was the education of children in incorporating adventure. Right, incorporating physical activity and meeting different cultures. And that was sort of when I decided to create my own programs, utilizing contacts I already had in the industry, but making something a little bit more niched, you know, towards a market of people that were seeking for something alternative than traditional education. And so that was sort of an easy place for me to start. And when I looked at people who have asked me for programs like that in the past, but it didn't exist, then I went back to those people and went, hey, now it does exist because I'm creating it. And, you know, I built social equity with you. I've worked with you in the past. Is this something of a project that we can work on together? And that's sort of how I got my first client. And to be honest, my employer at the time also became my first client, because I negotiated a transition consulting gig with them. So I was working full-time with them, right? Being a business development director, handling multiple territories in the world. And then I said to them, listen, this is what I want to do, but I still want to continue working with you. Here's where I see you needing me in terms of the advancement of our business, but I'm going to be a consultant. Here's how it benefits you. So I have to really sell, you know, the idea of cheaper cost to hire me, because I'm not working in the office. You're not paying for health insurance. You know, all those things, I'll take care of it by myself. We negotiate a fair consultancy rate that allowed me to work from home and be available for meetings once a month, right? And I also helped them to hire, to replace the parts of me that weren't going to be there anymore. So it helped them also say yes to that opportunity, because it wasn't like, too bad, screw you, I'm quitting. It was sort of like, here's how we're going to do it together, and making sure that you win at the end of it as well.
And, you know, the first thing that comes to mind for me is, holy shit, that's a pretty risky conversation to start with your boss, your manager, your executive, whatever, you know, whoever you need to talk to about stepping back from full-time into a consultancy kind of role. So, you know, if you can remember back, what kind of hit did you take as far as, you know, what you were earning from that job at the time?
Well, you know, this is the interesting thing about when you really look at the real numbers. So first of all, I had been afraid to quit for years, because I was making a six-figure income, you know, and I was about to be made partner of that company as well. So that's two things to risk, right? This future of partnership. I was 26 at the time. So being made partner at that age is a huge thing for me, you know, and a huge accomplishment I've been making goals to meet. And then I had to really look at whether or not the time, you know, when I actually look at what I was making. So I don't know what the taxes are like where you are, but taxes in Canada are pretty high for particular income brackets. So what it really in reality was going on with my paycheck was that 40% of it was going to Uncle Sam, right? And what I really took home at the end of it after taxes, and if you divide that by the number of hours I was spending on trips and conferences and work I was taking home, you know, to make that job work for me, I was making less than my assistant on an hourly basis, you know? Nice. And that was a reality check for me to go, wow, I'm really hustling for this title, really hustling for this prestigious status, but actually I wasn't even taking home that much and bringing home more stress. So that was sort of the first thing I needed to get a reality check on to motivate me to go, it might be a little bit better to work for myself and actually put in the same amount of effort, except I reap the benefits of it. You know, that was sort of the first motivation. Now, the second thing is obviously having to know what my own break-even point was to live, right, comfortably. Mm-hmm. What if I was not to eat out every day and be really mindful and conscious about spending? What do I really need to survive in a place like Vancouver? And that number was a lot lower than what I thought I had to make once I actually truly looked at the numbers and cut down, you know, unnecessary spending and expenses. And that, again, made it a safe condition where that number to hit on a monthly revenue goal or a paycheck goal was a lot easier to reach than I need to make six figures in order for me to quit. You know, that was sort of the formula I had, was that until I made six figures in a consulting gig, I'm not allowed to quit, because that was sort of giving up something. You know, but when I really looked at the numbers, that was sort of, you know, became a much better truth for me in a way. So when I went down to a consulting role and negotiated that pay and that amount of hours, which was about 25 hours a week, it actually equaled out to about the same amount of money that I was making on a full-time basis.
Wow, and with a whole lot less work.
That's it, a whole lot less work and a little bit more focused on what it was I was producing rather than just being in charge of a whole department.
Exactly, which personally I think is very satisfying.
Oh, big time. You sort of get more fulfilled and know that, hey, I'm completed in that project. It was very project-based. It was very goal-oriented to specific things, you know, that I would be responsible for rather than some of the things that I don't like doing. You know, in the company. And that gave me more, I guess, juice to really work on things. And they saw better outcomes as well coming from me as a consultant that's very focused on specific results.
Yeah, I like it. So if I had to tie a nice little bow around this, figure out how to structure a win-win for everyone, basically.
100%. And go in it without blaming someone, you know, blaming your boss about how unhappy you are, because that's the last thing they want to hear. You know, but really see how your new role or your new transition of a role that will help to benefit and give value to them in a different way, you know, and how you can support them through that transition, whether it's helping them hire to replace you or offering a certain amount of time where you're onboarding a new staff member so that they're not left high and dry. And I think that's a really good way to approach it.
This is gold. I love that. So Lydia, one thing I want to talk about is savings. Do you have any hard and fast rules that you typically teach people about, you know, maybe let's call it smart dollar amounts to have in their savings accounts before quitting their day jobs? Or is that not really relevant?
I think it is relevant, but the number and that goal could be different for different people. Now, someone with family or have medical bills. I know in America, you guys don't have huge healthcare system there. Mm-hmm. So that's something that needs to be considered. And I have lots of clients that have, you know, particular illnesses that do require them to be on a medical health system, and they can't always just quit right away, you know? And they have to account for that. And when you have kids to feed and, you know, things to take care of, that's something to account for. Now, for me at the time, as sort of a single woman, for me, the safe conditions were 6 months of living expenses saved up ahead of time in order for me to feel comfortable to take that leap. Now, for everybody else, that could be different. And I think that there is no fast and hard rule, but it's something that you should really look at your own life and go, what are some of the things that I need to, that are non-negotiable, right, for me to have to pay into and can't be cut down? And what are the true numbers that I can actually eliminate off how I spend my money in order to know what my break-even point is in a month, and how much of runway do I need in order to feel safe? And that is going to be different for different people. Now, in commonly, what I found that most people, from all the people I've worked with in the past years, usually anywhere between 6 months to 12 months of savings of living expenses for their life is usually around that ballpark of where people feel safe to quit. And on top of that, before they quit, to have clients in, you know, so that there's a confidence in that I have something going for me, even on a part-time level, in order for me to know there's traction in my work.
Right. I think it's smart to have both of those bases covered too, because, you know, going back to what you said earlier, if you don't feel safe, it's hard to really tap into your creativity and actually do well in your business.
Absolutely.
So you've gotten to work with tons and tons of people through your work with Screw the Cubicle. And I know that's kind of been your number one focus for the past few years. So looking back at all of the different people you've been able to help, what would you say is your sort of number one piece of advice? What bubbles up to the surface most often for people who are considering quitting their day jobs?
Well, the one thing that I see people struggling with when they come to me is usually around this question of what business should I start? They've been going for years, looking at, I mean, taking courses, being tricked by marketing of what it is their vocation of choice from these really snazzy marketing out there, you know, the make six figures in 6 months by, you know, having an Amazon shop or learning e-commerce or learning how to monetize a blog, you know. And so they tend to look at what business they should start as sort of more of this external thing where I'm looking at who else is making money, you know, and how can I jump on that wagon? Or looking at what's the newest thing that I should be learning or upskilling myself on to make money. And the truth of the matter is, what's easier for you to start and what's probably more meaningful for you to start in the beginning of time is probably something you already know. So my belief is that there is already expertise. There are skills. There's so much experience that you've already accumulated in the years you've been a professional that there's so much information there that you should be working out what that side hustle should be or what that niche or business you should start should be rather than trying to look externally and trying to conform to that. And lots of people I see do that. You know, they sort of look for the newest craze of an idea and try to learn something new that may not actually be their strengths. Mm-hmm. You know, there's nothing wrong with e-commerce. Oh, for sure. And there's nothing wrong with those e-commerce businesses or drop shipping or whatever it is that people see that are the quote unquote make money while you sleep models, right? But at the end of the day, not everyone's built for that. Some of us are built where we only care and have motivation to sell something is when we care about the thing we're selling. I'm definitely exactly. built that way. And that's probably why I think my own corporate journey was sort of very miserable for me was because I was selling things I didn't really believe in. So for example, I didn't believe in traditional education, but I was selling traditional education. And that ate at me for years. And even my first business didn't survive that meaningful card because I was, again, selling something that was somewhat in value, but not all of it. You know, and I think that is a question we need to ask ourselves is what am I meaningfully contributing to that, yes, gets me paid, but also something that has longevity in my deep interest in it. And I think deep interest counts for something. It's something that's not teachable in that sense, mm-hmm. where if you have deep interest in a topic, in a problem that you're solving, in an impact that you're making, it really does help you navigate through some of those initial first year struggles of building a business. You know, whatever business you built is going to be hard. It's something new, but it's harder when it's a topic or a subject that you don't have interest in.
Exactly. I mean, I'd argue that deep interest is, you know, by far the most important part of choosing your business idea, because if you don't have that interest, as soon as you run into your first roadblock or things get tough, it's like, well, screw this. I'm going to throw in the towel.
100%. You would just check out before you should check out, but very likely it's because there's no more reason than money. You know, to continue that business. And if money is your driving factor, I would say stay in a job. Mm-hmm. That's much safer to make that revenue in that sense. Find a sales job, exactly. There's tons of them out there. But if the reason to start a business is to have autonomy over your work, to have impact, to contribute meaningfully, and there's something around the intrinsic motivation to start a business, then so much more this question is so important. But a lot of people disregard what they already have. You know, the communities they've already built, the talent they already have showcased, the experience they already come with. And even if the thing that you're working on right now in corporation, it doesn't bring you joy in the sense of sometimes it's not the job. Sometimes if you diagnose it deeper, it's maybe the people, how they're operating their business, you know, how there's no culture in that business, or you're forced to do things you're not in value. Right, with your highest value. That may be actually the problem rather than the job itself. Mm-hmm. So we have to sort of understand which parts of the jobs that we've done in our lives, our body of work that we've built, there was a reason why you were attracted to one of the jobs to begin with. And there's some common threads that bind these careers together. There's something that drew you there. And what was that before it was tainted? You know?
That's great advice.
And that is what we want to sort of look at. These themes and things that already occurred in our career, and utilize what exists and repurpose rather than re-begin again. You know? And that feels a lot more easy and more, you know, we can do it now, than go and learn a new skill or go back to school or go and learn a new talent. Because you have it already. If you've made money being successful professionally, you have the drive, and you just need to find out which pieces of your career can be leveraged into a new audience or a new contribution that still utilize the same skills. It's just for a different mission or a different message.
I love that. This is pure gold. So Lydia, we're getting close to the end of our time that we have here. So I want to ask a few of my frequently asked questions that I designed to be intentionally short on my end. Your answers do not need to be equally so.
Okay.
What kinds of sacrifices have you had to make over the years in order to put enough time and effort into growing your business?
One of the things that I would say has been something I've had to navigate more is the personal relationships in my life. And that was partly because of the choices I made to be a digital nomad, where, to be honest, the reality of loneliness is very much present when you travel and you change communities all the time, and there's transient people in your life. But when I was in Vancouver, when I first started my first business, the loneliness was also there, not because there weren't family and friends around me, but there were the people around me weren't in the same dream. They didn't have the same reasons to want to do a career like I did or create a lifestyle that I wanted to create. So there wasn't enough people to sort of talk to about my changes, that why I was giving up a six-figure job in the middle of an economic crisis in Vancouver. You know, my friends were getting laid off. Here I was quitting my job. Who do you think you are? That was sort of the ambience I felt. So I've had to say that I've had to really explain reasons why I no longer could go out on weekends at times, or I couldn't spend money on big trips I used to spend with my friends in order to invest in my business and in order to carve out that time for the first year to learn, which is more time than you anticipate ever, right? When you have to build something brand new. So that's it. Having to spend more time on the business, not be as frivolous with my time, be very conscious about who I spend it with and the reasons to spend that time. But I did have to scale back on my sort of leisurely personal time, waking up at 4 a.m. working on things and not being able to go out on a Friday night. And that was sort of, in my head, short-term sacrifices for longer-term gain, which is not always understood by the people around you. But, you know, you have to sort of believe in that first in order to also can, you know, help other people understand why this is priority for you and garner their support for this new transition you're doing.
Yeah. And I'd argue those sacrifices, those short-term sacrifices in order to get long-term gain are much easier to justify too, going back to what you said earlier, when you're doing something that you're deeply interested in, and motivated by.
100%.
Do you have any particular strategies, tactics, ideas that you've tested over the years that come to mind that ended up being a failure?
Oh gosh, there's been so many failures. Which one do I pick? You know, when I first started diving into the world of coaching, which I never thought I would do because, to be honest, I didn't love the word coaching. So even now, whenever people go, what do you do? And I'm like, well, I'm a corporate escape Sherpa. I'm a guide of sorts, but you are going to be your best coach. You know, I didn't want to be that sort of guru that's like, come to me and I know it all. And I was more interested in building a platform or a space for people to actually birth ideas rather than tell them what to do. But to be honest, in the beginning of time, as you know, when you first start a business, you sort of want to please. And whatever clients you do get, you sort of take from desperation. And there's been many times that I didn't test out ideas before I launched them. So it was sort of this, you know, a practice that I did where I thought I had to have all the answers by myself and say that this is what people needed. So in the beginning, it was sort of testing out these ideas, helping people, helping coach people to come up with ideas and just land something that they're passionate about, right? That was sort of the only motivation for that first program. And I never really asked people if that was something they were actively seeking, just finding out something they're passionate about, but not really doing anything above and beyond that. I just thought this is important to me and it should be important to other people. And I never had a conversation about what that meant to them, you know, what that journey looked like to them. So I would launch that program and go, hey, everyone needs to learn this. And I hope you pay me to learn this without validating if that was really the message and that was really the journey they wanted to go on. So that failed in that sense of that I wasn't able to recruit the right people that would be right for that program because I didn't have these conversations with these mm-hmm. people. So what I think I would have learned, Ryan, which is also what I teach now, is that there is this place before you go out there and put all your eggs in one basket or spend money and time investing in a product or a service, is to have a space to beta test some of these concepts and ideas and journey you anticipate taking your customers on. And also not disregarding that the power of asking is beautiful, that none of this has to be done alone. Just because you're an expert doesn't mean that you shouldn't have the humility to gather information from the people that you are thinking to help. Having real conversations is a huge thing. I was really trapped in the beginning of time into automation, right? Everything was like technology driven. I should be automating everything. But what I really discovered is that a personal brand like mine, intimacy is the big differentiating factor, mm-hmm. especially in service-based businesses, especially in any business that is in the business of helping. You have to get back into the roots and the raw thing of just talking to people. You know, but here I was doing surveys, all automated things, instead of getting on a call, taking people out for coffee and going, how can I really serve you? And what do you anticipate this ideal journey could be for you? What can I create for you that can help you solve your problems and help you not to keep up at night, you know? So mm-hmm. the power of asking is something that I definitely do now with all my students, but also for myself. Anytime I launch something, it is fully, fully validated with real conversations. And I know that when I create something, it's being created from what is being asked, rather than what I think instinctively is the thing I should build.
Exactly. I think this is a really important lesson. And I kind of liken it to community building. So, and one way that I apply this in my own business is anytime that I'm even considering launching a new course, a new program, whatever it may be, I go out and recruit people to kind of join as beta testers. And ooh. I take my assumptions about what I think the course needs to cover. But I actually just work physically through their own little challenges. And we always come up with unique little scenarios that I wouldn't have otherwise thought about. You know, you walk away with testimonials, real results for real people. And the end result, the product that you emerge with is completely different than if you were to just sit down and do your, you know, your curriculum writing in a silo.
Totally. And you're so right about, you know, running it as this tester before it goes live for the testimonials, because it's actually from the feedback of your audience and your clients is what's going to refine and improve what you're offering. And you're more confident to sell it because your students are telling you what worked for them. What was the aha moment? And, you know, sometimes it's not what you thought it was. You know, like, for example, for me, when we look at programs or retreats that I sell, you could think obviously, oh, you get to launch a business and you get to know what you're good at and what business to start. And that could be an obvious outcome. But actually, when people go through the programs or go through the experience, they're actually gaining other things in areas that you may not have thought of because it's been such a while that you've been where they are. So your mm-hmm. students are really going, man, actually what I came for, I thought was just business starting and ideation. But what I came out from is this idea that I have something to offer. I have this confidence in this talent I have. And I had mastery, you know, in these skills that were dormant or weren't being utilized. And now I can confidently show these skills and be rewarded for it. Or it's the idea of, you know, being able to be a much better expert in things and being able to come up with programs that are well thought of, you know, that gave them the confidence to sell. So that real life feedback for testimonials helps you to even pick up the languaging, you know, mm-hmm. and the emotions that really you should be articulating when it comes to the value of your work, but not through what you think, but through real experiences that have been had from the students that go through your beta lab.
All right, Lydia, this is going to be my last question for you. What's been the best investment you feel you've ever made in the context of growing your business? And this could be in the form of time, money, tools, products, services, education, or otherwise.
I think the best thing that I've ever done is to get out of my own way and know that I can't do all the things on my own, and actually started hiring help, a real human, way before I was ready to do so. And it started sort of as a VA, a person who was a VA to start with, that helped me to now obviously have a bigger team. But obviously my best hire right now is my OBM. My online business manager is an excellent person that really helps me to focus on what I do best and know that the other parts of, you know, the back ends of running my business doesn't have to be me. And the idea of outsourcing as a perfectionist has been a journey to let go of control and let someone else handle all the technology pieces and systems and tools that make my business run easier. But also to know that my time should be spent on what people pay me for, right? Which is the advice and the content and the strategic ways that I should be helping people and spending time building my business that way rather than learning, you know, all the codes I need for my WordPress blog or learning how to do something on Canva. You know, that doesn't have to be me. It can be very replaceable. So hiring a team that actually just supports me, whether it's a VA to start, and, you know, I hired from the Philippines in the beginning of time because of how much bigger our dollar is there. You can get more. They're excellent VAs that you can get in the Philippines. And it was affordable. It's like $200 a month for a part-time assistant. And that really helped me to get in the practice of having a team member, not having everything in my head, having tools and SOPs in my business so that it can go beyond me. And so that when I do hire more team members in the future, it's set up that way where it can welcome and onboard another human without it being myself that has to train every single time.
Great advice. Okay. Well, Lydia, thank you for joining us. Can you tell everyone listening where they can go to learn more about you and everything you're up to?
Yeah. Screwthecubicle.com is the best way to get a hold of me. We have excellent free resources there, all about career transitions, building a business and growing a business. I have a YouTube channel that you can find as shows and interviews. I do a corporate escapees as well on screwthecubicle.com. And then depending on when they listen to this podcast, we actually have a 5-day side hustle challenge that's happening on July 16th. But if they go on my website, they'll see the replays for it. They can sign up for it after as well. But we are running the live version of it on July 16th of this month.
Yes. Awesome. And we'll include the links to that in the show notes as well. So Lydia, thank you again for joining us.
Ryan, thank you so much for having me.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Side Hustle Project, I would love your support. Head on over to the Apple Podcasts app and give us a rating. And as always, you can catch every episode of the Side Hustle Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for tuning in.